It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning. Welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Bill Bransford, your host this morning, and I'm in the studio with Carol Bonassaro, President of the Senior Executives Association. Carol, welcome to Fed Talk.
Thank you for having me.
It's always a pleasure to have Carol here. We're going to talk today about the Senior Executive Service, the Senior Executives Association, and in general, what's going on with career leadership in the federal government. Carol, tell us a little bit about the Senior Executives Association.
Well, the association is a professional association, which means that we don't represent any individuals. Rather, we focus on the interests of the Career Executive Corps. And we have an overall mission of good government. So there have been some moments over our 30-year history where it may have been in the interest of many senior executives for us to do X, but we did Y because we thought that it was in the greater interest of the government long term. We were started 30 years ago, indeed, because the SES was created a year earlier. And after those of us who were so-called super grades at that time transferred into the SES, a number of the features of the SES that had enticed us started to be changed. And a number of IRS executives, interestingly enough, I don't think anyone tends to think of them as rabble rousers, decided that they needed to do something about it. And the association was formed.
And you were there, I think, one of the early board members?
Yes, when the board looked around and said, gee whiz, it's a bunch of us guys, and I guess we better get some gender diversity here.
So what does the Senior Executives Association do for its members today?
Well, the primary thing we do, obviously, is to deal with issues that affect the Corps, and in particular, our concern that the future, the Corps continue to attract and retain in the future the very best and the brightest. So in that regard, whatever we accomplish obviously accrues to the interest of everyone who is in the Career Federal Executive Service. So in order to make membership itself attractive, make it attractive for executives to support the association, we do offer a number of benefits. Once a year, we have a mentoring program that's primarily of interest, obviously, to those who are aspiring to the SES, but also to the newer senior executives. We also offer twice a year a webinar called What's So Different About the SES Anyway? Because we learned over time that many of those who not only were in the candidate development programs, but who came into the SES did not realize how tremendously different the personnel system was from the GS system that they had left.
It's fundamentally different from being a general schedule employee.
Extraordinarily different. In fact, it's interesting, Bill, as you know, since you do this this webinar with me, since I put that PowerPoint together, gee, it's probably 4 or 5 years ago now, it just grows all the time. And every time we do it, we say there's another point we'd better include so that they're fully aware. We also usually have a monthly brown bag session on topics of interest to our members. And most importantly, though, they get information so that they can be aware of what's happening that will affect their careers. And they have the opportunity to get advice from us. As I say, we don't represent individuals, but it's not unusual for someone, for example, to call and say, I'm being geographically reassigned. Can you tell me what my rights are?
Or I'm having trouble with this political appointee. Is there anything I can do about it?
Absolutely.
Carol, the how do you become a member of SEA?
Of SEA,
the Senior Executives Association. First of all, what are the requirements for membership? Do you have to be a senior executive?
You have to be a career executive, and that means a senior executive, a member of the SES, or the equivalent, so that we do have and we do represent the interests of senior level, STs, and other equivalent executive services, and there are a number of them now. We also accept for membership those who are on the executive track, for example, SES candidates.
And if someone wanted to be a member of SEA, what's the best way to join?
To go to our website, which is seniorexecs.org, SENIOREXECS.org, and they can learn a great deal about the association, what the benefits are, what our history is, our accomplishments, and they can join online. They can pay their dues through payroll withholding or annually.
All right. And right now, I think what the activity that you're working on the most is your annual conference. It's coming up here very, very soon.
Yes. On June 16th, we have a very interesting day called Managing Smarter. We're going to have Tom Davis, former Representative Tom Davis, talk to us about what's going on in Congress and how it's likely to affect not only their careers, but really their ability to manage their agencies. We have a Rear Admiral retired from the Coast Guard, John Acton, a very, very interesting fellow, who's going to talk about something called the tyranny of the operational moment, which is a very fancy way of saying when there you are as a senior executive trying to focus on getting the job done, meeting the expectations for your performance, and there are tons of interruptions in every workday. And how do you deal with that and keep your eye in the big picture?
That's something I'd like to learn more about myself.
Me too. And we have a number of breakout sessions, managing executive stress, which is not surprising, managing the decision to retire. Another one is professional liability, which obviously you're extraordinarily familiar with, because a lot of managers and executives are unaware of their liability and how that can play itself out.
And what that liability is and how that affects day-to-day decisions.
Absolutely. So anyone who's interested in the conference, it is June 16th at the Grand Hyatt. They can go to our website as well, seniorexecs.org, and click on the agenda and a registration form.
And you do not have to be a member to go to the conference.
Absolutely not. Thank you for
Although if you go to the conference, you might want to join.
Well, hopefully, yes.
If they're eligible. And you don't even have to be eligible for membership, I think. A GS 14 or 15 who was interested in those topics.
Someone who sees themselves on the executive track, absolutely.
All right. Carol, what are the what are the important issues right now that you think that affect the SES?
Well, I think that overall, there's no denying that the beating that federal employees are taking in general is worrisome when we think about the executive corps. And that's particularly true because I guess it's almost 2 years ago now we did a survey because we kept hearing that there were very talented, able GS-14s and 15s who were being encouraged to apply for the SES or to get the training to get on the track. And they were suggesting that they had little or no interest in doing so. So we said, we really want to get a better handle on that. And 12,000 14s and 15s responded to our survey and cited, we asked them about the attractors and detractors. And the biggest attractor was, interestingly enough, the lack of work-life balance, because we know that these executives, many of them are basically on call 24/7. Secondly, their concern with regard to geographic relocation. Now, what was really interesting to me was that they didn't select as an issue in the survey itself, pay. But if you read the 3,500 comments, which we did, almost inevitably they mentioned that given the detractors, the pay was not sufficient to overcome them.
In other words, if you're a GS-15 Step 10, you make $155,500 a year. and you don't get enough of a bump and you go into the SES to make it worthwhile.
Yeah, one of the my favorite stories about that is it was a focus group with senior executives, and one of them recounted the story that he was all dressed, ready to go to work a Saturday morning, having a cup of coffee with his wife, who was reading the paper and looking forward to a leisurely day. And she looked at him and said, "Is that extra $1,500 a year really worth it?" So our concern really is, what are we doing, what should be done to ensure that we continue to attract the best and the brightest and not the best of the willing. So that's a major issue. And I think with the pay freeze right now, the cutback in performance awards, some other, the concern about other potential changes to federal employee benefits, we know that an awful lot of senior executives are eligible to retire. And if and when they do, which they eventually will, again, we have to come back to a concern for who's going to take their place.
You're listening to Carol Bonasaro talking about the Senior Executive Service on Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back after this break.
Hello, my federal friends. It's the Geico Gecko, and I've got good news for you. I might even say it's some of the best news ever. Okay, well, definitely in the top three. The big news. Geico now offers discounts for most federal employees GS7 or above, which is no doubt a lot of you out there. So you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, all with a company that began over 70 years ago with the sole purpose of serving government employees like yourself. Yeah, that's right. Geico, the Government Employees Insurance Company. And today, well, we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. And did you know about Geico's 97% customer satisfaction rate? Well, saving money tends to make people rather happy, I think. So congrats again to those federal employees GS7 or above. Welcome to the Savings Club. Mike?
Got it. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. The Gecko's right. Discounts are available for most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
Welcome back to Fed Talk. This is Bill Bransford, your host, and I'm here in the studio with Carol Bonasaro, the president of the Senior Executives Association. If you'd like to join in our conversation about the SES, career leadership in the federal government, what's happening to federal employees, you can call us on our toll-free number, 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So, Carol, you were talking before about the issues affecting the senior executive service and the fact that GS-14s and 15s are not interested. And are you seeing this play out? And, you know, 2 years ago you did this study, and what are you seeing happening now, 2 years later?
Well, again, we unfortunately have to rely very often on anecdotes. And I know I have heard from a number of agencies that are having difficulty filling positions, or that receive a relatively small number of applications for their SES positions, and those applicants are not of the quality they've seen in the past. So that is a concern, but unfortunately, we don't have real hard data.
Because I hear chief human capital officers make comments about, well, there's always lots of applications, and you know, for these high-paying jobs, but you're hearing that the quality of the applicants isn't what it used to be.
Well, in some situations, yes, and that the number is not what it used to be. I mean, it's almost inevitably true, and in that there'll always be applicants, although there are some cases where there have been none. But you do have to raise the question of the quality. What's interesting, though, is that the same time that we are seeing the negative side, so to speak, with the pay freeze and the cutback and performance awards and so on, at the same time, the President's Management Council developed an interest in the SES and has taken on something called the SES Initiatives.
Tell us, what is the President's Management Council?
Well, it's basically the group of deputy secretaries of cabinet-level agencies who meet to address management issues. I think we've seen this with virtually every administration that comes in and at some point says, what are we going to do about or to or for the SES? Usually the issue arises around the question of mobility. But in this case, they've taken on a number of issues, professional development, performance management, expanding and diversifying the applicant pool, and so on. So they have a very large number of initiatives that they are
proceeding on. It seems like those initiatives have been around for a while. I mean, is there a different spin on them that the President's Management Council
Well, there are a couple of new things. I mean, one that is new that we think is important is so-called onboarding. I mean, the notion that someone moves into an SES position, and even though they may have gone through a candidate development program over that first year, they are surely going to hit situations that they hadn't anticipated or find challenges that are tough. So the argument is that they ought to receive some special attention during that first year, that agencies ought to prepare very well for their first couple of months, that they ought to be offered mentoring and coaching and really be paid attention to. In other words, the point is, let's do everything we can do to make them successful.
One of the things I've seen, Carol, and as I've watched senior executives in particular situations, is that the real art of being a senior executive is the ability to interact at the political level from one administration to the next and convincing political appointees of different stripes that your purpose, your whole reason for being is to run government programs, and you don't really care who's in charge. That's an art that needs to be developed. And it seems like that's something this onboarding process could start to inculcate in new senior executives.
Yes, although, as you know, it does take two to tango. So it is true that that's something that needs a fair amount of attention, because I think that the last time, well, with the transition from the Bush to the Obama administration, we did some work on transition materials. And I was very surprised to see at that time that if we looked at the length of time senior executives had been at the SES level at that point, only half of them had ever gone through a presidential transition before. So the issue of how you handle that, how you brief a new appointee, you know, not to overload them, but to give them the critical materials, how you work with them to adjust to their working style and so on. That is a talent or a skill that senior executives need to learn. But there is another side to the coin, and that is that political appointees have to come in not thinking that these people are beholden to the last administration, and to really understand that career executives are there to make them successful.
And that's something that SEA, I mean, actually promotes and helps provide training on to develop senior executives along those lines?
Well, we've done a number of things. We do have on our website, we did two things that we thought would be helpful to political appointees. One is a primer on the SES. In other words, knowing that a new appointee is going to come in and be overwhelmed by a lot of material, we did a primer. So the bare bones information, what do they need to know about senior executives? Why are they different? What can they do to them for them? What can't they do to them? And the other thing we did was put together another piece that explains to them how to work successfully with senior executives, obviously making the case that they're there to make them successful, but also, for example, that it's important to communicate fully with those executives so they can understand what those appointees want and need. So that is one very critical thing I think that we did.
So I'd like to talk a little bit about the most successful senior executives, those who receive presidential rank awards, which is a special category of awards available just to the senior executive service and to SLs and STs. Can you talk a little bit about that and what the Senior Executives Association does for those executives?
Well, when the SES started, what was presented for the system was a real balance between risk and reward. In other words, those who transferred into it would understand that they were going to give up a number of rights. They could be reassigned, whether geographically or not. But they also, and they had no job rights. So it's very tough for any executive to deal with a performance action that affects them negatively. But on the other hand, they were going to be able to receive performance awards, a.k.a. bonuses, be eligible for presidential rank awards. Distinguished awards are to only 1% of the career senior executive service, meritorious to up to 5%. And they're fairly rigorous standards. The nominations are looked at by an outside committee, and they do have to go to the White House for approval. And these are just some astonishing people who have done amazing things. So each year we do a banquet, Black Tie Banquet, Department of State diplomatic reception rooms to honor the distinguished rank executives.
Carol, can you give me an idea what some of these distinguished rank executives actually do for the American people?
Well, I've got a few from those who were at the banquet this year. One served as the lead negotiator for the international agreements for the International Space Station. So she managed to get partner contributions of $8 billion. Another one received a National Innovators Award for integrating computers into clinical care in VA hospitals. Another one was able to, he's in charge of all equipment that soldiers need, and he delivered over 9,000 highly survivable, mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles to soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he did it within 2 years of program development. And it's a process that would normally take 5 to 10 years. Overall, these executives who received the awards in 2010 saved the government $37 billion.
Wow. And what do they get in return? They get the recognition, they get a black tie event. They also get a cash award.
Well, let's use the term recognition loosely, and I'll be glad to explain that. Yes, they do get a cash award, and we worked very hard a number of years ago to bring it back to its original value. So for a distinguished executive, it's 35% of salary, which sounds like a lot until you consider how much money they save the government and their accomplishments.
It's over a period of years, these accomplishments.
Yes,
it's not
distinguished
just
is, yes. Meritorious can be on a shorter term, something accomplished in a year or two, but distinguished is really basically a career award. So to me, they are extraordinarily defensible, but frankly, the association is the only source of their public recognition.
So even though it says presidential, it's the Senior Executives Association that recognizes them.
Yeah, the last time I do recall quite distinctly that the last president who presented the awards individually, shook their hands, took a picture, was President Reagan.
Wow. So what's happening now with these distinguished rank awards? It seems like that's a great way to talk about what career leaders do for their country.
I think it is. And if you want to make public service cool again, when you read about what these people have done, I mean, they they are the epitome of cool. I mean, one of them piloted space shuttle flights, for example, was the first mission that was dedicated to life science. In any event, I think, unfortunately, that in this economy and given the political atmosphere, the administration, apparently, from what I can tell, is nervous about these awards because of the dollar amount. Although, again, I think they're extremely defensible. So this year, the call for nominations went out very late, and there were some new requirements placed upon them that, frankly, I find very unsettling, which is a very polite way of saying
how I find
them. What
kind of new requirements?
Well, that the Federal Investigative Service will go in to determine whether the statements in the nomination are correct. That is to say, whether they accomplished what it alleges they did accomplish.
Has that never been a problem before?
Not that I'm aware of.
And have there been safeguards for the vetting process to make sure that these people nominated for awards truly deserve them?
Well, I think so. I mean, their nominations are looked at by outside committees. It does go to the White House. It goes back to the agencies before they're announced. And there have been executives who have lost them because they might have an outstanding EEO complaint against them, for example. And even if it were later determined to be unfounded, they don't receive them in the end. It's a lost opportunity. The other new requirement is a criminal check. And no, I'm not aware that that's ever been a problem before. So it seems that they feel some need to tighten these requirements and made very clear that given the current budgetary situation, they expect to see far fewer of them.
And how many are there distinguished executives a year?
Well, it's 1% of the career SES, so it averages around 60.
So, and there are how many career senior executives?
Over 6,000.
Just
that's
over
6,800.
Mm-hmm. So, and they expect to see half of that. It seems like a fairly small number of highly outstanding people.
It does. And as I say, it's an extraordinary opportunity to really let the American public know what government employees do. And I think there are a number of good reasons for doing that now, not the least of which is attracting people to civil service, but also defending government mission.
You're listening to Carol Bonasaro, the president of the Senior Executives Association. She's talking about the Senior Executive Service. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back.
Hey, it's the Geico Gecko. Now, as a federal employee, you're probably one for a smart presentation, so I've put together some charts and graphs here. There you go. That will help illustrate the money you could save by switching to Geico. First thing you'll notice is that GEICO now offers discounts to most federal employees GS 7 or above. Now this is big news. But that shouldn't come as any surprise from a car insurance company that has been serving government employees since 1936. And as you can see on this graph here, it's probably why we're the third largest car insurance company in the nation. Yeah, no, I do actually realise you can't see these, but trust me, they're rather impressive. Especially the 97% customer satisfaction rate. And when you consider it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more, well, all you GS7 employees or above should just contact GEICO. Tell him, Mike.
Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey, and the Gecko said it best. Most federal employees GS7, the equivalent or above, could get a discount on their car insurance. Just call GEICO at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local GEICO office to see how much you could save.
I'm Deborah Roth, host of Fed Talk, and partner at the law firm of Shaw, Bransford & Roth. Our firm specializes in helping federal employees with legal issues concerning their jobs or benefits. For two decades, we have been representing federal employees in adverse action cases, employment discrimination complaints, inspector general and internal affairs investigations, security clearance issues, and other federal employment disputes. If you have a legal concern, don't wait. Call Shaw, Bransford & Roth at 202-463-8400 or visit our website at shawbransford.com.
This is Bill Bransford, your host on Fed Talk, and I'm talking to Carol Bonasaro, the president of the Senior Executives Association. If you would like to join us, you can call us on our toll-free number, 1-877-936-9333, or you can email us at fedtalk@federalnewsradio.com. So, Carol, you were talking earlier about the concern that good quality GS-14s and 15s were losing interest in the SES and weren't applying. Tell us a little bit about the application process. How does somebody who is interested in the SES get in? Isn't it difficult?
Well, many agencies do run candidate development programs. Some of them, and for which one has to apply, by the way, and be selected. So that is certainly one route. And some agencies do a better job than others of actually placing those who complete the program in SES positions. For example, as best I can tell, the IRS places everyone. Other agencies, I've heard concerns. You've got those who have completed the program successfully, as far as they know, but are still struggling to find an SES position. If you do complete an OPM-approved program, then you can move into an SES position without competing for it. Although you
can just be selected.
Yes, you will still have to go before what's called a qualifications review board. And that's a process that we think at the association is very, very important. It's to really assure that anyone who's moving into a career position meets the requirements for the senior executive service.
And the qualifications review board is run by whom? How does that work?
By OPM. And what they do is select or find three willing senior executives, career executives, typically from different agencies to sit on the board and review the qualifications of the candidate. And over the years, what that has amounted to is a statement of their executive core qualifications. There are five of them.
The ECQs, as they're popularly known.
Yeah, over the last few years, a lot of agencies don't like the process. They've made arguments that it slows down hiring, which we think is rather bogus, since all the evidence points to the lengthy hiring process occurring primarily at agencies, that the QRB process takes, on average, about 2 weeks. And, you know, our concern is that it's a fail-safe mechanism in the sense that it keeps the SES from the possibility of being politicized by hiring people who are selected less for their qualifications than for their policy or political views.
So these ECQs that SESers have to have some experience in before they can be selected, they're sort of like the KSAs for the general schedule?
I suppose you could argue that. I mean, you're looking at your ability to lead people, business acumen, and so on, which is not unreasonable given the jobs they're moving into.
And KSA is, of course, knowledge of skills and abilities. For those of our listeners that don't understand that acronym, most federal employees do. And KSAs, of course, are on the way out. They're being replaced by a resume-based application process for the general schedule. Is that kind of thing happening in the SES as well?
Yes. Some agencies have adopted resumes only. And in fact, to the great consternation of some SES candidates who worked very hard preparing their ECQ statements. So they are utilizing resumes on the theory that obviously it makes it easier to apply. Our problem with that is that you then have to supplement that with really structured interviews. You have to work harder to collect the information to assure that these people, in fact, meet the ECQs.
Such things as leading people, managing change, business acumen. Mm-hmm. Well, those are all, I would think, very important things for a senior executive to have qualifications.
And I think there are some ways around this where we can, you know, split the baby and say, all right, initially you can accept applications, but when you get down to your top three candidates, at that point you should receive an ECQ statement. And that should go to the QRB. Right now, what some QRBs are getting are grids of, you know, you can find this bit of information here and that bit there. And we think it's that becomes a much more difficult process.
So Carol, the president announced last, I believe it was December, late November, early December, a two-year pay freeze for federal employees. And it also applies to the senior executive service. How has that affected the SES?
Well, it certainly hasn't been a morale boost because SESers are in a pay-for-performance system, and they've been in one since 2004.
Well, actually, we're in one earlier. They've been in more of a pay-for-performance system
this
since 2004.
This is true, because the pay-for-performance earlier was totally focused on the performance awards.
Right.
And their annual adjustment for their steps in the SES were in fact cost of living adjustments, if you will. Now, every pay adjustment is totally based on performance, and it's totally at the discretion of the agency, so that someone could theoretically, and we are aware of a few cases, receive an outstanding and receive no pay increase.
Or a performance award.
And you can cut back on performance awards. So what happened with pay freeze is that many executives felt, I think rightly, that they should have been rewarded for their work in 2010. Unfortunately, what agencies have chosen to do over the years is to make that adjustment in January of the following year. So when we got to January of the following year, there was pay freeze. So executives never received recognition for what they in fact accomplished in 2010, with the exception of if they received a performance award.
And executives are still permitted to receive a performance award under the president's announcement?
Yes, although there is a draft memorandum circulating that says we are cutting the percentage of the SES salary pool that's to utilize for these awards in half. Although it's a draft memorandum, frankly, my understanding is that that guidance has been in effect perhaps verbally.
Already. And of course, then that's important for our listeners to know that the performance awards are different from distinguished rank awards.
Yes.
They're for annual performance, and they're limited to no more than 10% of the total SES payroll. So what is the new directive, the draft?
5%.
So it cuts it in half.
Yes.
And what's the message that the civil service, the potential senior executives of the future receive about coming into the SES?
Well, I can't imagine what, frankly, and what anyone would be thinking logically about why it would make sense to want to move into the SES, because it's almost become a crapshoot. Come into this system where the demands, the challenges are extraordinary, especially now. You're in a system where there's no cost of living increase. Theoretically, your performance will be recognized, but not really right now very much. I think it's very hard to make a case that right now that you should be giving up the kinds of protections that you have in the general schedule to come into this system, even though you'll be doing the most important work in the country. It's satisfying, it's challenging, and I think everyone who is there doing it is clearly not there for the money. But when you face these kinds of issues, it's demoralizing. It's a demotivator.
And Carol, you just raised an excellent point, and I've read some of the studies that SEA has done, and senior executives really love what they do. And I think that's an important point. As we talk about these detractors and the lack of morale, overall, SESers are a very content group of people who make significant contributions.
Because they know they're doing important work. And you're right, they really do love it. We do every year, in connection with our banquet for distinguished rank executives, we bring them together for something called a morning of reflections, which we do with the Kennedy School of Government. It's the only time they're ever brought together to talk to each other. And it's inevitably a fascinating conversation. And we've had topics that range from, you know, political career relations, to the challenges they're facing government now and how do you keep your workforce motivated, focused on the outcome. But one of my favorite quotes of all time was we were talking about political pointy relations once, and one of the distinguished rank executives said, let me sum it up this way, distinguished executive today, dog meat tomorrow. And as he said that, it was perfectly accepting. It was, I love what I do. I care about it. I understand it can be a tough environment. And to some degree, that's okay.
I'm going to do the best I can. But yet, a GS-15 employee who's got a telework agreement to telework 2 days a week, who's got a 4-5-9 schedule where they're off every other Friday, they essentially work, they don't take their BlackBerry home with them. They're not tethered to their BlackBerry like a lot of senior executives are. And, of course, some GS-15s do have jobs that require mm-hmm. them to go above and beyond, but some do not. And they look at their senior executives, always at the office or always connected or sending emails at 9 o'clock at night. It must make it hard to make that transition or think about making that transition, because they can't always see how good their senior executives feel about the work they do.
Well, and especially as we look at the younger generation, which is more concerned about work-life balance. And I was at a meeting once at the Chico Council, and one of the topics on the agenda was telecommuting policy. And every other organizations around the table were weighing in, and the OPM director looked at me and said, well, you know, what do you have to say about this? And I said, well, frankly, not much, because our executives telecommute on evenings and weekends. So, I've had a board member who was told that he had to have his BlackBerry on literally all night long and be prepared to accept communication at 2 a.m.
All right, we're talking to Carol Bonasaro about the Senior Executive Service. This is Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We'll be right back after this break.
It's the Geico Gecko with a little hello to all you federal employees. Now, in government, there are people on all points of the political spectrum. But there is one thing that everyone agrees on. Saving money is good. Which brings me to the big news. Geico now offers discounts to most federal employees GS7 or above. It don't matter if you're a Democrat or an aristocrat, left wing, right wing, or a chicken wing. If you're a federal employee, GS7 or above, you could be saving a lot of money on your car insurance by switching to Geico. So no matter if you're blue or red or, in my case, green. If you're a federal employee, GS7 or above, contact Geico and see how much you could save. Isn't that right, Mike?
Exactly right, my little green friend. Hey, folks, this is Mike Causey. And like the Gecko said, discounts are available for most federal employees, GS7, the equivalent, or above. Just call Geico at 1-800-947-AUTO, go to geico.com, or visit your local Geico office to see how much you could save.
This is Bill Bransford, your host on Fed Talk. I'm in the studio talking to Carol Bonasaro, and we're talking about the Senior Executive Service. So, Carol, we spent all this time talking about what's going on, what the administration's doing, some of the anti-federal employee rhetoric, the pay freeze, the impact on the Senior Executive Service. What's SEA doing about this?
Well, let me just say one thing first, because I always feel compelled to say this when I talk to any group of SES wannabes, which is that in spite of all this, I hope nothing would discourage them from aspiring to the SES, because it really is the best place to be. One of the things that we are doing is proposing an SES reform bill, some legislation to try and fix some of this. They're not huge fixes, but we think they're things that would help. And one of the things that would help would be to take these performance awards and count them towards the high three, the annuity calculations, because performance awards are an integral part of their compensation, particularly when you are in a pay-for-performance system.
And so that would be if performance awards were included in the high three for retirement, assuming high three is continues to be the law.
Yes.
Then senior executives would have the opportunity to earn a higher annuity when they retired.
Yes.
That sounds like something that might get a GS-15 to apply if they had the chance to do that, you know, if their bosses decided they were worthy of a performance award.
Well, it would be something to make it more appealing. And right now we need something to make it more appealing. There's one other provision. There are a number of provisions, obviously, that we're pressing for. But one would make it put a statutory ban on the use of quotas in performance awards. That's something that we
Appraisals?
Performance appraisals. Thank you. I didn't have enough coffee this morning, apparently. Over time, I think it's been fairly clear to us that there are quotas operating. They may be unspoken, but there's a real effort to push down performance appraisals. And if you're in a system that is a pay-for-performance system, I think it's really important that people think it's fair, that you're going to be judged on the basis of your performance and not subjected to an arbitrary quota system. So quotas are prohibited in the regulations. We think it should be prohibited by statute.
They're prohibited, but they're ignored.
Ignored, yes. Yeah, so hopefully putting it in the statute would make people take it more seriously. But sometimes I think we need to make it a criminal provision. But that's just me.
And I would mention to our listeners that I work regularly with Carol on these issues. I'm general counsel of the Senior Executives Association. I help draft the legislation. One of the other things that this would do, Carol, is it would deal with some of the mobility issues that everyone's talking about. Senior executives should be more mobile. That was one of the original ideas of the Corps. Can you tell us what SEA believes should be done about SES mobility?
Well, I think one thing that would be make an enormous difference would be if OPM would collect, and it would have to be mandatory from every executive, the kind of information that, for example, Navy collects from its executives right now, which is information on their education, their skills, their experience, et cetera. And also Navy collects some information with regard to their interests in additional professional development, obtaining additional experience, but also collects information from them with regard to anything that would inhibit their moving, some family issues, children in school, elderly parents, et cetera. In any event, if we had a database of executives that agencies could go to when they have a vacancy or a particular need, that would encourage mobility. Because right now it's totally incumbent on the executive to apply elsewhere.
And there's this sort of idea that if you move around a lot, there must be something wrong with you. There are exceptions to that. If you're available for developmental assignments in other areas, other agencies, other sectors, that you can be spared. So what's wrong? How come you are not so important that you can't be spared? How do you overcome that mentality?
Well, you know, it's you overcome it by putting the emphasis on the other syllable, namely enabling agencies to go look and say, I'm looking for someone with, you know, X and Y skills because I have a vacancy and I'm not coming up with candidates that I'm satisfied with. And that means that basically you're enabling executive searches so that you have agencies coming to you as opposed to the executive who has to go looking and overcome. Obviously, in any agency, many times they're going to be concerned to keep the opportunities open for the people who have come up through that agency. And so that is a dilemma, too, that has to be overcome.
One of the other things that the legislation that SEA has proposed does is it raises the stature of the career senior executives by requiring that certain positions be filled by career SES. Can you tell us a little bit about why SEA wants to do that?
Well, you know, if you go back to when the SES was established by law in 1978, but implemented in 1979, at that time, every assistant secretary for administration was a career executive. If you look now, the only career executives who are left are those in those departments where by statute that position must be filled by a career executive.
And not always necessarily at those.
And not always observed. And we think what's happened over time with all of the political layering, too, is that there hasn't been as much of an opportunity for executives to be able to move up and accomplish more. That it's inhibited communication between top political leadership and the career executives who have to carry out policies and programs. So that by opening up some of these positions and saying the CHICO, if not the deputy CHICO, the chief information officer, if not the deputy, has to be a career person. And if you want to propose someone who isn't, you'd better give us some good reasons. That's going to make the service more attractive as well. And interestingly enough, research has shown that actually career executives are far more competent and successful at managing than our political appointees.
So The legislation would require certain positions to be filled, and what else would it do for as far as political appointees? The layering you described. How can that be somewhat challenged?
Honestly, that conversation has gone on over the years in virtually every institution you can think of, whether it's Volcker or commissions or whoever, has recommended that we cut back on political appointees. One of the things our bill would do would be that there is a requirement right now that only 10% of the SES can be filled with non-career senior executives. However, that is the formula is based on allocated positions, not filled positions. So our legislation would say, let's base it on filled positions, because that would keep the proportions in order.
And I think under current law, that 10% figure, even though it's government-wide 10%, you can go up to 25% in a particular agency.
In an individual agency.
SCA is proposing to reduce that.
Exactly, and say it's got to be on the basis of filled positions, but also reduced.
And Carol, you talked about this pay-for-performance system that went into effect in 2004 with a new performance management system with certification and more emphasis on performance appraisals. And how's that working out? You've taken a few surveys on that. And how's that working out? And what does the proposed legislation do to kind of fix?
Well, it would extend the period for which an agency receives certification, for one thing. Agencies have to submit a fair amount of paperwork to assure OPM and actually OMB that their performance management system for senior executives meets a number of criteria, which is to say that it really is results oriented, for example. And so they've even had to submit, let's say, about 10 to 20% of performance standards for examination. So it's become a very paper intensive process. It's a way clearly of driving not only a management agenda, but I don't want to say a policy agenda, but clearly the administration can put the emphasis this way on where it wants to see movement and progress. And so it's made the lives of HR people and the agencies much tougher.
And uncertainty on whether performance increases would be available to higher paid and more successful senior executives because of the exercise that agencies have to go through every year.
Exactly. And it has raised a number of other questions with regard to executives themselves because of the emphasis on really almost trying to make their standards more numerical, more clearly results-based. And some have raised the question of, well, how do you measure leadership, which is really the critical part in motivating the workforce?
All right, Carol, we have about 45 seconds left, and I think we might go back and just re-look at the conference you have coming up, if you could talk just real quickly about that and how somebody might sign up for that.
June 16th at the Grand Hyatt, and it's Managing Smarter. It's one day that's really packed from morning to very late afternoon. They can go to seniorexecs.org, and click on the agenda, click on a registration form. And anyone who visits the website, seniorexecs.org, can also learn more about SEA, our member benefits, what we've accomplished, and they can join online. And we do need the support of career executives.
Why is
who
it
receive,
so important to have that support?
Well, they receive the benefits of what we do, and it'd be nice if they helped to support, enable us to do it. We could do a lot more. And when executives don't join, what it really conveys is we're not concerned about the issues that affect our careers.
Thank you, Carol, for being our guest on Fed Talk. I appreciate you being here very much and telling everybody about the Senior Executive Service. That's all the time we have for today. And thanks to our listeners. And we'll be back with another Fed Talk edition very soon.